Live on Tape, Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between. With award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Workspan's Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. Here are your hosts, Tom and Charles.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Work in Progress. My name is Tom Alexander, and as always, I am joined by my good friend and podcast partner, Charles Epstein. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Tom. You know, we always like to talk about our podcast being very eclectic, the broad range of guests and the broad range of topics we cover. And today's guest, I think, is the living incarnation of eclectic, actor, writer, producer, director Michael Elias, who joins us from LA today.
Yeah, very much looking forward to this. He has done, I mean, you look at his resume, it's just eye-popping.
Yeah, what an amazing career. Got his start in New York theater, for a time did stand-up comedy, moved to LA, among his produced screenplays with A Jerk, yeah. Frisco Kid, fun movies, and actually very smart comedic movies, as you'd expect, given his background, which we'll get into when we talk to him. And if that's not enough, easy for me to say, yeah. He's written two novels, most recently a tense psychological thriller, is there any other kind, called You Can Go Home Now.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know too many relaxing psychological thrillers, you know?
No.
Not like reading, I wouldn't say.
No, absolutely. And this was tense. It did have the expected, I'm not sure if I should say expected plot twist, maybe a little bit of an oxymoron, but you do expect this kind of novel to take some odd, unexpected turns. And this one, of course, did exactly that. I enjoyed reading it over the weekend. I think I gobbled it up in two sittings.
Wow.
Which I think is a testament to how involving it really is. But really just an amazing body of work, and I tell you, it's good to see that he's still, after lo these many years, still very productive, still creative, turning out very fine work. We should be so lucky, Tom.
I'm telling you, yes, absolutely. He is an inspiration, still cranking, and it's very, very cool. Michael Elias is our guest. He's next right here on Work in Progress, back right after these words.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with kings, nothing with crowns. Bring on the lovers, liars, and clowns. All situations, new complications.
Pay equity matters, and not just because it reduces legal risk. It has profound ramifications on company culture, engagement, recruiting, and retaining top people. Syndio is a data science-powered software platform that enables modern organizations to close the gender pay gap while reducing costly unwanted attrition and improving true engagement and collaboration. Studies show the pay gap will be around for another 200 years. 200 years! Go to www.synd.io. SYND.io.
You grow to be
Michael Elias, has worked in motion pictures, television, and stage as an actor, writer, producer, and director in New York, Los Angeles, and London. Created and produced the award-winning series Head of the Class that ran for 5 seasons on ABC, starring Howard Hessman and Billy Connolly. Michael wrote and directed the Showtime jazz drama Lush Life, starring Forrest Whitaker, Jeff Goldblum, and Kathy Baker. His produced screenplays include The Jerk, The Frisco Kid, Serial, and Young Doctors in Love. His play, The Catskill Sonata, about blacklisted artists, was directed by Paul Mazursky. In 2012, he published his novel, The Last Conquistador, and he just published his second, a tense thriller, titled You Can't Go Home. And he joins us now from Los Angeles. Michael Elias, welcome, sir.
Hey, how are you? Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you. Welcome. And please say hello to my podcast partner, Charles Epstein.
Hi, Charles.
Hey, Michael. Hi. Thanks so much for joining us. I tell you, that's one hell of a journey from Monticello, New York, not to be confused with Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. Oh. So from Monticello, New York to L.A. and Paris. By the way, I spent the first 12 summers of my life at a bungalow colony in Monticello called the Castle Country Club. The fondest memories of my life happened in Monticello.
Well, my father was a doctor in this little town 9 miles away from Monticello called Woodburn. Its distinction was it had a state prison, and our warden went on to become the warden of Attica, if that's a wild thing. And it was a great wave. And my father had an office in Monticello and, you know, went back and forth. So I don't know that bungalow colony, but all of my friends in high school, their parents owned bungalow colonies. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah. Do the names Sam and Emma Tropp ring a bell?
No.
Oh, okay. No. Yeah, because they happen to be the owners and proprietors of that particular country club. But 12 of the best summers of my life. And I still remember the sounds of the Monticello racetrack wafting through the summer air.
Yeah.
Really, just great, great stuff. Anytime
there was famous delicatessen, Kaplan's.
Yeah. And anytime I'm anywhere and I hear our car crunching over some gravel, I'm always reminded of making our approach to the bungalow colony. It's just always. Anyway, I see that you got your degree in mathematics and philosophy. A good friend of mine majored in physics and theater, which I always thought was very impressive, as few are able to fully engage both halves of their brain. I'm wondering how someone who studied philosophy and math found himself drawn to the performing arts.
Well, I went to this school called St. John's College, which is the great book school. And I really majored in philosophy because that was the bulk of the curriculum. The mathematics, maybe I was the minor, but I always wanted to be, and I think that's growing up in the Catskills and being in, you know, in the entertainment, a world of entertainment in the summers, and maybe that inspired me or wanted me to become a writer or an actor, whatever. I wanted to be in that. I didn't. And I guess philosophy maybe clarified my way of thinking, and my way of approaching problems. And I think that helped a lot. And I think it was the best college I could have gone to if I wanted to become a writer. I never took a writing course at college, but because we studied the liberal arts and the great, you know, the Western canon, and we, the Greeks, the Romans, we had theology, we had everything right up to the present. And we never read textbooks. We only read the original source material.
The primary text.
So that's it. I learned calculus from reading Newton and Leibniz. I learned, we had to study Greek and learn Greek. And then I read the Bible, the New Testament in Greek, some of it. And anyway, that was my education. And we had a theater program, but it was all just ad hoc, whatever we wanted to do. And I found myself acting and really enjoying it. And we put on early Brecht, Beckett. We did Endgame and Waiting for Godot. And that propelled me to go to New York to try to become an actor. And I went equipped with this quasi-degree in mathematics, which allowed me to get a job as a school teacher teaching mathematics in junior high schools and high schools, which enabled me to avoid the draft and stay out of the war. I was essential. I got a deferment. So when Kennedy in 63 said, if you are married, you are now exempt from the draft, and I was married. I was a young married kid. And then I said, this is great for me. Now I became a substitute teacher and could spend more time working in the theater and auditioning and so forth. And then I started taking improvisational comedy classes and met a guy, and we were really funny together. And we became comedians, and we had a comedy team. And we played the Catskills. I went back to the Catskills as a comedian, playing in the same hotels where I was a busboy. And then we had a kind of modest fame even. We were on the Johnny Carson show four or five times, and a producer from L.A. called me and said, I like you. Who are your writers? I want to hire them. And he said, we write our material. He said, well, would you like to come to Hollywood and be comedy writers? We said, yeah. And that was the beginning of my writing career, in a sense, writing television. And then climbing the ladder or whatever, but we started with variety shows. And then from variety shows, we moved to sitcoms. And then eventually I teamed up with a guy named Rich Eustace, and we wrote a show that got on the air for 5 years, so the head of the class. And then at the same time, I started writing screenplays with one Frisco Kid with one partner, Young Doctors in Love with Rich, and The Jerk with Steve Martin, because Steve and I were writers together on a little variety show called Pat Paulson's Half a Comedy Hour. Remember Pat Paulson from The Smothers?
Yes.
Yeah, anyway, that's how I met Steve Martin. He was a writer. So we teamed up and started writing stuff together for him. I started writing with him, for his act. And then he said, listen, I have this screenplay, and it had just been rejected by Paramount, and I need a rewrite, and would you come and rewrite it with me? And I did. And it went on to be The Jerk at Universal. So
talk about circuitous, my God. It's like Aristotle to Aristophanes to Newton to Carson.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
Wow. Yeah, well, it was once a writer. I mean, there still is a great science fiction writer, Bob Silverberg. And he wrote a beautiful book that I wanted to option. It was called The Man in the Maze. And he wouldn't give me the option because he didn't say it. But I think at the time I was a comedy writer. He's not going to option his serious science fiction novel to a comedy writer. So I said to him, listen, I know where you got this story. He said, you do? I said, yeah, this is Philoctetes from Sophocles, which I had read in college. He said, how do you know that? I said, I know that. It's my favorite play, and you stole it. He said, okay, I'll give you the option.
That's good. It can't be too many people who came through the St. John's Grant Books program and became a comedy writer.
Actually, there's one other guy, Jeremy Levin. He didn't become a comedy writer, but he wrote a Marlon Brando movie, I think, with The Freshman. No, what was it called? He was a pretty big screenwriter. No, there aren't many. I may be the only like down and dirty comedy writer, you know.
Right.
I'm the only graduate who wrote material for Rodney Dangerfield.
That's great. Well, I got to say, with all these Greek references and as the show's resident Greek, I have to say, ευχαριστώ.
Well, Elias, you know, I get Elias is a Greek name.
Yes, it is. I wasn't sure. I thought maybe there was a little bit of a Greek connection there, but
I think it may be Thessalonia or something. My great ancestors who were expelled from Spain and made their way to Greece and then up north into Hungary and.
Wow. Well, you know, you sort of touched on my next question. But I'm gonna pivot here a little bit. I mean, obviously, you've had an amazingly eclectic career as an actor, a writer, director, just about every medium, and multiple genres, comedy, straight drama, and such. You know, and you shared with us your big break. But, you know, it's interesting. What's interesting to me is the sort of the comedy drama aspect and how you, I guess, have to put on a different hat, if you will, in shifting from one genre to the next. And talk a little bit about that, a little bit about that transition and thinking humor and then straight drama. And, what's the approach like?
Everything has to have humor in it. If it doesn't, it's like, please. I mean, you just have to have humor. So, and there was always this distinction between, and sometimes people would say like, well, you write comedy. Did you ever write anything serious? And I would say, comedy can be very serious, you know. And it's actually then there's that other, you know, the dying words of as he died, he said, comedy is hard.
And your friend Steve Martin, comedy isn't pretty, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. We work very hard on it, and we say a lot. We need it, and. On the other hand, I did want to move to subjects that interested me that don't make for comedy, such as anti-abortion terrorism or abuse, violence against women. The thing about the Frisco Kid that really interested me was not to have was not as a comedy, but to show the odyssey of a dogmatic Eastern European rabbi to his journey to become an American. So that in crossing the country in the company of a bank robber, Harrison Ford, Gene Wilder becomes an American. He's still a Jew, but and so that interested me. And it interested me also because I had never seen growing up Jews in cowboy movies. So I said, I think we need one. And then I did a lot of research and found out that Jews, like everyone else, had made a real contribution to the founding, you know, to the West and so forth, and had interesting relationships with Indians. And I mean, that's a whole other. So I think and I wanted at the same time to keep it funny. I mean, keep stuff in it that was funny, because there is something comic about a rabbi trying to make his way across the country and so forth. So, and the jerk is pretty flat out comedy. There's no question about that. But at the same time, it was, when he's told that he's adopted, when Navin Johnson, Steve Martin, is told that he's adopted.
That's a classic scene.
Yeah. And he says, you mean I'm going to be this color all my life? So,
classic.
So, yeah. So everything, I don't think I write comedy today in the sense that I used to write. I'm starting another novel. Although I have to say, I've written another novel, which is going to go out soon, which is basically my life in Hollywood, fictionalized, so I can tell the truth. It's whether it's a kind of a Pat Hobby story, but it's about a writer in Hollywood and all this. And stuff happens to him that's, I think, is pretty funny. But at the same time, he's got a lot of serious stuff going on. So that's one. But the idea of, say, going on a sitcom and writing a sitcom or writing jokes, that's over.
There was always that rumor. There was always that rumor, and I'm not sure it was just a casual rumor. It was probably meant to undermine him in certain ways. But Wyatt Earp, I think, was long rumored to be Jewish.
Oh.
And also it's kind of interesting, a character in Deadwood, the Timothy Oliphant second. He was Jewish. So it was kind of an interesting way of introducing that concept.
Yeah, listen, I will tell you, the chief of the Acoma tribe in Santa Fe, Taos, and that pueblo was a guy named Solomon Bibo, a Jew who I think was German, who married the chief's daughter, and they elected him the chief. He's actually a Jewish Indian chief, and he kept the pueblo. He kept it alive and kept it going and kept it in there, you know. And then there's a great, the greatest sharpshooter of the West. I can't remember his name. It was not Annie Oakley, but it was a guy, you know, his name was Herman Schwartz, I swear, something like that, who was also a great. So anyway, there's a history of the Jews in the Southwest that's fantastic. And in truth, they settled in the border towns. In Mexico on both sides of the border. But in one town, I think maybe Nogales in Arizona, the frequency of language was in order. It was English, Yiddish, and Spanish. That's how many Jews were there. And what happened was you made your money in the Southwest, and then you went to San Francisco, and that's the gold waters.
Exactly. You know, this idea of a Jewish Indian chief. It's great fodder for potential comedy. I mean, what does an Indian infused Seder look like?
Yeah. Well, this is for real. I mean, Solomon Bibo, look, Bibo.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, you know, I'm curious. I'm assuming in your industry, broadly defined, it's very easy to be pigeonholed, and in a sense, to be pigeonholed, another way of looking at it is to have a particular brand, and to break out of that is probably very difficult. So I'm assuming it has been kind of difficult, because a lot of people look at you as a comedy writer, screenwriter who writes in a particular genre. Has that been a challenge, or has it in a way been kind of liberating, because you can break out of that box and you have more to do and more to offer?
Well, two things. One is, I did get reputations. I mean, in the beginning, it was a comedy writer. There's no question about it. Then I went to work for Bill Cosby, and I worked for Flip Wilson, and I mean, I wrote for Cosby, I wrote for Flip Wilson, and then someone else. But then I had a reputation as a guy who writes for black people. That was weird. And I got, all of a sudden, I found myself being offered jobs on black shows. And then writing, there used to be a real distinction between you're a television writer or you're a screenwriter. And as a matter of fact, the Writers Guild had two divisions. It had the screenwriters division and the television writers division. And they were not friendly. And it was very difficult to cross over. But with the Frisco Kid, where I got originally, Mike Nichols was going to direct it before Robert Altman. That changed everything for me and my partner, and we were now allowed to do other things. But there is that. The real hard brand is age. I'm unemployable, and I have been for a long time. And I don't know how to break out of that, because what can I do about it, right? So, and there's a movement to make ageism, and from the Writers Guild, an element of diversity and inclusion. Because I hear showrunners or producers brag about their writing staff. You know, we have, and they will give you the list and so forth. They'll never say they have anybody over 55, and they don't. So that's the hardest one. And that's why I actually, I say I got a friendly divorce from television, because I did. But it really was because I reached a certain age and I couldn't work. And I'm not alone. And So that's a really serious problem. And there's like, for instance, you know about the Academy is saying, well, we're going to have standards now for pictures qualifying for Best Picture awards, and we want to know how many minority people worked on this and so forth. And that's great, and I'm all for it. I'm not in any way being retro about this, but I say, but the one category that's not said is people over a certain age.
Yeah, so, it's kind of interesting because there is a huge market of people 55 and older. We had on our podcast several weeks back a Wharton professor who wrote a book about trends. The book was called 2030. And one of those trends, people working past 65, working longer, and companies embracing that because they realize these are people who have a great deal of experience, you know, still are youthful, still are healthy, and they can still contribute in very meaningful ways. But you know, that is probably right now more the exception than the rule. But as people start to recognize, and he says in his book, 70 is the new 55, or, you know, you can go up, 75 is the new whatever. Yeah. But that takes a while for it to seep into the general consciousness and for that to be more broadly embraced.
Yeah. And there, I mean, there are guys who have maybe some of them made empires a little bit along the way, but I never did. But and the other thing is my feeling about creativity and experience is somebody says to me, how did you think of that idea or how did you come up with that? The truth of the matter is it may have been a movie I saw when I was 12 years old. I don't know. I think creativity is 90% memory.
Yes, information.
And the other 10% is adjusting it and making it useful. So I have, at my age, if you put me in a room with a bunch of writers, I might have 30 or 40 years of hundreds of movies, hundreds of television shows, hundreds of books that I've read. And when it comes to a solution for a problem that we're dealing with in the story or where to go, I may have the answer, which is not, I'm not saying, oh, you know, let's steal this thing from a Bogart film, but I may have that, find that, in other words, I contain the knowledge. Yeah. And I can be really useful, but they don't get that. And
do you still keep a routine? Do you get up every day and write? Or are you still sort of
I have a weird,
like that?
Yeah. I have a weird routine, though, and I try to avoid writing until I can't anymore. And then I sit down and write during the day. So I almost never get up and hit the typewriter or the computer. And I usually drift into it. And the truth of the matter is my best hours are like 3 to 6 or 4 to 7.
Has that always been the case or just X amount of years?
It's only when I start writing novels. That's what I would do.
And is that where you're primarily focused these days?
Yeah. And I have screenplays that are in my drawer and I take them out from time to time and say, oh, you know, I just read an article and that so-and-so is looking for something, a noir screen. I have one, so I'll bring it out and I'll edit it, change it and fix it up and go out with it.
Michael, you've turned your hand to novel writing in 2012 with The Last Conquistador, which prompted one reviewer to write the following. To his gritty portrayal of contemporary Peru, brilliantly researched recreations of Incan Peru in its royal heyday with all its ancient pomp and human sacrifice, plus a hot-blooded romance between a Hispanic FBI agent and his long-lost archaeological lover, Elias brings a veteran screenwriter's gift for cinematic immediacy to this stunning, imaginative high adventure. Now, that's a blurb, folks. What prompted you to try your hand at novel writing, and how was the process different from your other types of writing?
Okay. Well, it came about, first of all, it came about because I went to Peru and I went on one of those treks, you know, with the Inca Trail and so forth. And I went to Peru. I went on this really ignorant. I couldn't tell an Inca from a Mayan. I didn't, I was a dope. But when I came back, I've said, you know, I'm going to find out where I've been. And I started reading about the Incas and the history of Peru and the conquistadors. By the way, they were Jewish conquistadors. And then I like, what if? What if there was a city that's still alive in the jungle? And that led to, that was the premise. So, and they're kidnapping children. And it just kept evolving. The idea, and then here's another example. The idea of a lost city. When I said to a fellow writer, my novel's about a lost city, he said, oh, another lost city novel. Good. And, you know, from King Solomon's Mines to whatever. So it's, and then I say I was immersed in Peruvian history, culture, and memories of my visit. And that's impelled me. And I said, you know, I think I could write this as a novel. And I did.
Which brings us to your latest, which, as I said, I read over just this past weekend, called You Can't Go Home, a psychological thriller whose central character is a single 31-year-old female detective named Nina Karim, or is it Kareem?
Kareem.
Okay. Yeah. Perhaps you can give our listeners a brief synopsis. Then I want to ask you a couple questions.
Sure. It's a story of a young Queens homicide detective who is investigating a series of cold case murders of men. And she finds out that these men who have been murdered, they have one thing in common. Their wives, at the time they were murdered, were in a battered women's shelter. And she goes into the shelter undercover to find out if there's a connection between this women's shelter and the deaths or murders of these men. At the same time, she became a cop, because she was looking for the man who assassinated her father, who is a doctor. And her mission is, when she finds him, she's going to kill him. She's going to extract revenge. And the two stories come together. Her being in the, trying to figure out the mystery of the shelter and trying to figure out who killed her father.
Yes, and a great twist at the very end. I mentioned at the outset of this conversation, Michael, that I spent 12 summers in Monticello. Some of your novel does take place in my former stomping grounds on Long Island, Merrick, and some other places. So there's a lot in your novel that resonated with me. And as with The Last Conquistador, the novel is very precise and, I assume, deeply researched. How long did it take you to write?
As I said, I think it was a couple of years, maybe 2 or 3 years. You were saying it was precise, and there seemed to be a lot of veracity in research. And I couldn't get into a woman's shelter, and they wouldn't let a man in. And I don't blame them, but I did read extensively as many cases as I could, and not memoirs, but recollections of women who had been in shelters. And I read, and I talked to women who had been in shelters. So I guess, and the research of Queens and Queens neighborhoods and American Forest Hills, whatever I used, it's all Google. It's and Wikipedia. It's amazing. You know, before you had to go to libraries, you had to call up people. And so
sure.
Now I can say she needs to get pizza. I can find out what pizza parlors are near her, and I can download their menus. So you can get everything right. And even when doing The Last Conquistador, writing about Lima, I needed information about the American embassy in Lima. Google Maps, Google Earth, there it is. Sure. And then it's up to me. However, the point is, it's up to my skill as a writer to translate mere information to something that is readable and enjoyable and makes you feel like you're there. I can't say we're now in the American Embassy in Lima. Click here for a link and you'll see what it is. So maybe books will turn out that way. I don't know. Anyway, that's...
Yeah, you know, how did you come to the idea about centering it on a battered woman's shelter? You mentioned coming across stories along those lines, but was there any single story? Was there an aha moment? Was there something that you read or came across? You know what? This is an interesting thing. I want to pursue this.
Yeah, I think I've always been aware of, not always, but maybe the Me Too movement inspired me to some degree, the idea that, and that femicide is such a serious question, and I mean, not question, serious event, and it's all over the world. And I wanted to get inside that and see, and then write about two things: revenge and why it is so important in our culture. We revere it. We love Clint Eastwood. We love Denzel Washington. We love when they kill the bad guy. And that's, there's no Clint Eastwood movie that ends in a trial. It ends with them, the villain, being thrown off a building, whatever it is. And yet at the same time, we're told that's antisocial, it's wrong, and we should reject it, which, by the way, I agree with. But I wanted to explore that in this woman who was looking for the man who killed her father and destroyed her family. So that, then I said, you know, if this takes place, if this is also about battered women, women in the shelter, she is one. She's a victim also because of what happened to her. So let's see if I can bring these two stories together.
Yeah, it is interesting because we are fascinated with that revenge narrative. But in the movies you mentioned, they're pretty one-dimensional. Death Wish, some of the Clint Eastwood movies. But yours is actually a psychological thriller. I think it's fair to put it in that genre because it's not so straightforward. She's wrestling with it. And obviously, you know, in the letters that she's writing to her brother, to her mother and so on and so forth, she's not just doing it. She's not just impelled with this just bloodthirsty, I got to even the score. She's wrestling with it. So that, yeah, I think, brings another interesting dimension to it. And also thought was particularly interesting is that, you know, it's very relevant to what we're going through now. I remember speaking with someone at the outset of the pandemic who predicted that with all the sheltering in place, we're likely to see a spike in both baby production and spousal abuse.
Absolutely. You got that right.
Right.
It's the numbers are going through the roof, and all over the world, wherever there's where women can't get out of the house, they can't escape. They have to be there with abusive husbands. It gets worse and worse. And the number of women who've been killed, I think I read this in England and in France, it's just rising astronomically. Yeah.
And there were, by the way, some moments of levity. There was some comedy in the book. Yeah. So you are true to yourself and true to what you were mentioning before.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks. Thanks.
Our guest is Michael Elias, of course, longtime actor, writer, producer, director based in New York, London, and where he is now and where he lives now, Los Angeles, California. And Michael, on a personal note, and we shared this prior to doing our interview, I grew up in the movie theater business, and I told you that I had to personally thank you for helping put food on our table, because movies like The Frisco Kid and Young Doctors in Love and The Jerk played at our theater, and you know, people came to see those movies. Hence, we made money on the movies. That was it. Yeah. So thank you for that. And plus, it extended my childhood. You're personally responsible for being part of that. I got to grow up in that business, which was a wonderful business. I did everything from take tickets and pull the curtain to run the projectors and
And by the way, Michael, in Tom's case, a childhood that continues to this very day. It's a remarkable thing.
Yes. I don't know how that's possible, but yes.
I get it. That's right. I mean, you know what, for me, the thing I loved about working in the movie theater, as I told you, I was an assistant janitor.
Yes.
Is knowing what was coming up, seeing the advance list, because a movie played for a week.
Right.
So the idea that I knew what was coming in 3 weeks, wow.
That's a big deal. Absolutely. Well, you know, just to the right of me is a closet filled with some memorabilia. And from those years that the theater was open, I bet if I look hard enough, I'll find something connected to Michael Elias, I'm sure. But it's pretty cool. We usually ask people come on how they're holding up during all this sheltering in place. As a writer, I'm sure you've been able to take advantage of the relative lack of distractions. But it's got to affect you, obviously, as it has everyone in other ways.
Yeah, it affects me. Yes, we have grandchildren that we see, but it's scary. You know, we're both cognizant of, you know, about going out and going to places. L.A., our section of L.A. is pretty good. You can't get into any store, restaurant, or whatever without a mask. And it's Westwood near UCLA.
Yeah.
The thing that hurts me the most or affects me the most is children, young kids. I have a son who's 28, and his life is interrupted. You know, he can't go out. He can't hang out. He can't go to a bar. He can't, and it saddens me. And he can't go to school, go back to school. You know, he could in a way, but it really is. And for all the people his age who all of a sudden have to go to, you know, law school in their bedroom and have to, I don't know how doctors, you know, medical students and how people who want to, you know, get out and just travel, you know, the idea of say, okay, you've worked for a while and just put on a backpack and go to Europe and walk around. All that stuff can't. And somehow I feel it's my fault. I don't know. I didn't vote hard enough against Trump or something. How did this happen?
We are holding you personally accountable, just so you know.
I feel responsible.
And as well you should.
Yeah, it's my fault. It's my fault. That's,
well, you know, the problem is you didn't vote twice. We told you to vote twice.
And the terrible thing is I don't have to. I mean, I'm in California. You know, he's going to lose here. There's no question about it. But it was funny. In the middle of the night, I woke up. I said, is it too late to move to North Carolina and change my resume? You know,
Well, your vote will matter.
Yeah.
Right.
I hear it. Anyway, but I have to say, I will say that everybody has it worse than me. I mean, I'm pretty lucky. I have a, you know, nice little house. I got a comfortable existence. I really do. And I'm not saying my traveling days are over, but they're not as important to me as they used to be. And I can't see my sister who lives in London, and I can't see my other sister who lives in Berlin. And I have no inclination, whether it's out of fear or whatever, of, you know, going to New York and seeing friends and stuff. So I'm here.
And you can always you can always take some comfort in your body of work.
Which
is not insignificant.
Well, not the body. I mean, the body of work. But what I can take comfort in is that I can work.
You can still,
do it. I can work.
You can still do it.
I know, and I can work as hard as I want, or not as hard as I want, but I can work, and I'm going to work until I can't, as Charlton Heston says, you know, hold a pencil in my cold, dead hands.
So, which brings you to my last question.
Before you ask your last question, yeah. Charles, I just have to jump in for 1 second and just ask, you said your body of work, and you talk about, I got to ask this, because you have stuff that's out there in the ether, it's pop culture, the jerk take, for example. And maybe a line comes back at you someday and you hear it. You hear somebody quote something from something you wrote. What does that feel like?
Well, if it's, you know, there's an interesting, maybe, but if it's said by an actor, I mean, I remember watching Forrest Whitaker do a scene. I was directing him, and I said, wow, that's really good. I wonder who wrote that. Because the actor, he kind of owned it, you know? So yeah. Anyway, but I would say, I would certainly say, you mean I'm going to be this color all my life?
Classic.
I would say that. And I would say, I have, we didn't talk about my play, The Catskill Sonata, which is probably one of the things I'm the, you know, the most proud of, because that's closest to my heart. That's my, my growing up and being a waiter, busboy in a little communist hotel in the Catskills, which they were.
So again, yeah, my last question, sort of to all this, you're working on a third novel. If you can tell us where you're at with that and what generally is the theme, or what's it about?
It's another thriller, I guess. If it thrills you, it's a thriller. And it's a woman is searching for her husband who's disappeared in a night scuba dive in Maui. So it's as far from Queens as you can get. And it's about Hawaiian, contemporary Hawaiian politics. And it's a murder mystery and what happened to him. And
so you do have a Hawaiian component in your most recent novel, of course.
That's right. You're right. I'm stealing from myself.
Yes.
I'm not using that character.
No. But, okay.
I'm actually, you know, it's an interesting thing. Sometimes I'm writing a scene. I said, wait a minute. Did I steal this from my other novel? I have to be careful.
Yeah. But really, all the best with this novel. I really enjoyed it.
Okay.
Great twist. Thanks. Great characters. Great.
So it's called You Can Go Home Now. And it's a, you know, you can get it on Amazon and all that stuff. You guys were great. It was a really fun conversation.
Well, likewise, it was wonderful for us, too. We really, really enjoyed it. We'd love to have you back on again sometime.
Okay.
When you found this novel out. You know, get this novel out. Hurry it up. We'll get you back on.
Yeah, okay. We'd love that.
And hopefully it'll be a little bit past pandemic. So we have some more things to talk about.
Yeah, okay. Take care, guys.
Michael Elias was our guest today. Long time actor, writer, producer, director, and now novel author based in Los Angeles, Michael Elias. This is Work in Progress. Back in a moment.
Data, the mantra of business today. It's nothing new to World at Work. It's no small feat that they've been collecting data on salary issues for its salary budget survey for more than 45 years. Think about it. 45 years. Curious to know how your company stacks up? HR execs in the know rely on World at Work's salary budget survey. Shouldn't you too? Go to worldatwork.org/salarybudgetsurvey to learn more.
Wrapping things up now on Work in Progress, along with Charles Epstein, I'm Tom Alexander. And Charles, you know, when you come up against someone like, not that we're going up against him, but when you run into someone like a Michael Elias with a resume like that, with a history and the stories to tell, man, you know, this is when the show needs to be like split into like a mini series, you know?
Yeah, this is one of these interviews where you almost feel guilty asking him questions, like you're slowing him down. We should have just rolled the tape.
Exactly. Roll the tape, get a bottle of wine, you know, just kick back and enjoy, you know?
Yeah, just a real great conversation. What a career, what a life, what an unusual path from studying Aristotle and Newton in college, performing with the Living Theater, the legendary experimental theater troupe, and of course going on to enjoy such a prolific career as a screenwriter, director, and playwright. And as we spoke at the outset, still going strong. It's novel. I'll tell you, Tom, it really was good, a proverbial page turner, or as I mentioned on a previous podcast, as I tend to read ebooks more than physical books, a real page swiper. Yes. Really, I could not put it down. A lot of great characters, a lot of crackling dialogue.
All right. It's the only dialogue I like, man. It's got to be crackling.
It was, and tense, yeah, up to the very moment you get hit with that unexpected plot turn, and a very satisfying denouement.
All right.
So, yeah. It was really good, and it sounds like he's embarked on his third novel, which sounds equally interesting. It looks like he's about to complete his trifecta, and hopefully when that happens, we'll have him on again, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely. Would love to have him on again. You know, there are some folks that just it's quite obvious they have to be return guests, and he he sits high atop the list. A lot of fun chat.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, one of these guys who, you know, to his very last breath, he's still going to be cranking, still going to be doing work. Really quite an inspiration. And speaking of that, and speaking of somebody who's always cranking out new creative projects, yeah. I have it on good authority that you have a new album that has just been brought kicking and screaming into the world. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about this?
Yeah, we slapped it silly, and it's alive and well. Very much looking forward to the new album. It's called Dreams in Blue, which is one of the tracks on the album, and it's a collaborative project in that it is music that was written for my son Peter's latest three films. As you know, he is an award-winning student filmmaker, and he is now getting ready to embark on his he's leaving AAA to go to the majors. He's trying to get into the the big leagues of filmmaking. So that's the next step. But his student films have done quite well and kind of put him on the radar. So he said, "Hey, Dad, can you write the music for my films?" And of course, I did. And the last three films he's done, I scored, and this is music from those films. And it's not just soundtrack music in that it's instrumental score. There are some actual songs on here because the last film, though I wouldn't stop short of calling it a musical, it had two characters in it that played, or I should say two actors who played characters who were musicians, and they both actually did do their own singing in the film, and beautifully done. Two folks by the name of Lucas Blando, young man from Kansas City, and a local young lady named Kayla Smith here in South Florida. Very talented both, great singers, and they brought the songs to life, and it kind of pushed me into a new realm of songwriting, because usually I'm, as you well know, used to playing piano with my jazz band and really composing instrumental music and prog rock and fusion and all that stuff. This was a departure for me, so I had a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to this album as much as any I've ever done. And it's
so these
three, it comes in, so it releases the 23rd of this month, mm-hmm. and it's on, you name it, Apple Music, iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, Deezer, Tidal, all those digital music stores. So that's where you can get it.
I hear time's not where it once was, but I've got the time, nothing but time. Maybe tonight I'll find the song that captures you. Just turning.
faces, how they mark the time. As we go searching for that feeling in our heart, we keep going, silence and
excellent. So, looking forward. I did sample some of the tracks, and really great, great stuff. Typically moody Tom Alexander work. And it was really interesting hearing some of your compositions. It's obviously, as you say, a bit of a departure for you to write for voice, I suppose you can call it. And I thought that was very effective. Nice to see that you're pushing yourself where your son is pushing you into new directions.
He has pushed me in that direction. And I was a little bit nervous about it, but I'm fortunate enough to be surrounded by two really great vocalists and a great producer, I should add, by the name of Emilio Martinez, who's actually in my group Earth Code. He's the bassist, but he's a great producer. Great engineer, guitarist as well, besides bass, great vocalist. So very talented guy in his own right. So, very much excited about it. So, Dreams in Blue releases October 23rd across the full, as they say, Charles, digital music spectrum.
Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent. So, I couldn't recommend it highly enough.
Thank you.
Listeners to this show, run out and get from Michael Elias' new novel, You Can Go Home Now, while in the background you're listening to Tom Alexander's new album based on the soundtrack work he did for emerging filmmaker Peter Alexander.
Absolutely. There you go. There's your daily double, if you will. So that's it, Charles, for another show. We certainly thank Michael Elias for joining us today on Work in Progress. For Charles Epstein, I'm Tom Alexander. We thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Work in Progress. So long, everybody.
This has been Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between. With award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Workspan's Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. For more, visit worldatwork.org/workinprogress. That's worldatwork.org/workinprogress. Join us next week for another edition of Work in Progress.